Welcome, everybody, to the Barr Smith Library this evening. My name is Ray Choate, and I'm the University Librarian here at the Barr Smith Library, and it gives me pleasure indeed to welcome you here. If you haven't been before, there is a very interesting reading room if you sort of thread your way around. The staff at the service desk can direct you. It's a neoclassical reading room, and it's one of the gems of architecture. Unfortunately, not too well known in Adelaide, but so if you're new to the library and would like to see it, please go down and have a look before you leave this evening. Now, the first thing I need to ask you to do is, if you have one of these, would you please switch it into the off mode? And while you're doing that, I would like to acknowledge the Kaurna people, who were the original custodians of the Adelaide Plains and the land on which the University of Adelaide's campuses at North Terrace, Waite, Theberton and Roseworthy are built. And now it gives me pleasure to introduce the new president of the Friends of the Library, Jane Lomax-Smith, who I think needs no further introduction.
Thank you, Ray. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm really pleased to be here this evening. I also acknowledge we meet on Kaurna land. And as I was coming in here, I thought we'd be of this age. We are of this age, let's say. I thought probably everyone in this room would either be or know or be aware of someone who was a mother who'd been forced to relinquish her child, because we're of the age group where so many of our friends would have been involved. And we would have known the pain and the anguish, and what it can do to a mother to be deprived of their child is almost something that's unthinkable. But how you respond to those events in one's life are really the thing that marks out someone who's special. And I think Meg has really turned an experience into an opportunity to change the world around her. And sometimes campaigning is debilitating, it's disappointing, but she succeeded. And she's been on the side of the angels and has come through to write a marvelous book, which I would remind you is for sale. And if you haven't bought it, please buy a copy. Consider buying a copy for your friends, two or three for Christmas, for women perhaps, but please buy books as well, because authors don't write unless they sell books, so please keep buying them. Now, Meg Hales has written this book, which was only published or released a couple of months ago, and it's already making waves because it tells the story of people's lives shattered, but with optimism and hope for the future. So can I introduce Meg and ask her to come and speak to you now?
Thank you, Jane. Thank you very much. Now, I have to be a bit careful because I like to wander around a bit, and I always think I'm going to start by sitting down, but I never do. So if I start getting some feedback coming in through there, it's because I'm getting too close to that point. So I'll try and do it from here, and I'll probably refer to my notes and my sister, who's going to make sure that I keep to time, because I'll talk for hours otherwise and you'll all be asleep. I'm Meg Hale. I'm a mother who lost a child to adoption in South Australia in 1968. I'm also a former social worker and a state ombudsman investigator. I'm now a writer and a published author, which is exciting, and a public speaker and a whole lot of other things, a grandmother, and I'm about to move to Canberra to be with my other daughter, who's been over there for 14 years and doesn't look like she's coming home, so I'm going to go and visit her now. I want to start off with talking a bit about why I decided to write a book. And it really came to me a long time ago when I had my daughter, my first child, but some years later when I had the opportunity to meet some women at an organisation called the Australian Relinquishing Mothers Society. And I'd had a little bit of information about them, because when I was at university a woman nudged me in the side at a lecture and said that she'd heard about these people who were meeting and were looking at forming a group for women who'd lost children to adoption. And I was too frightened to do anything about it at the time because I hadn't dealt with my own loss. But several years later, and many newsletters later, because someone had put me on their list, I went to a meeting, and that was me sold on this notion of working through my own issues of losing a child and helping to change things. Some years later, when I graduated, before I graduated, this is probably more interesting than when I graduated, I did my final social work placement at ARMS, Australian Relinquishing Mothers Society, ARMS. And I was halfway through writing my thesis on what we called ourselves Relinquishing Mothers in those days. And I was halfway through writing my thesis and I got a call from the Department for Community Welfare to say that my daughter had gone on the contact register. It was before the legislation changed. And she wanted to meet me. I'd been on there for years, and so had her birth father, who I'd got in touch with through other friends. We hadn't been speaking, but I did get in touch with him through other friends, and he wanted to meet her as well. So I met my daughter, who was then 19, when I was writing my thesis. The rest of my thesis was pretty rubbishy, actually. I didn't care much about it after that. I then went to work at ARMS after I graduated. I worked in mental health. I worked at Glenside Psychiatric Hospital. And ARMS got funding, and I'll come back to that in a moment, but ARMS got funding, which was pretty remarkable in itself. And so the people at ARMS asked me if I would like to be their social worker, or to apply for the job. It was a pretty done deal that I was going to get it. And so I became ARMS first social worker. And it was really a combination of working there for a number of years. The legislation had just changed, opening up records to adopted people and birth parents. And there was so many things that were happening that it was a dynamic, terrifying, interesting time. But I'd also followed these women and been one of these women in the lead up to that legislative change. And it occurred to me, and not me alone, that there was a really important story to be told about this amazing bunch of women who, in spite of themselves, had stood up and said, something was wrong here. We didn't want to give up our children. We want to know if they're alive. We want to know if they want to know us. And they fought for law changes to give them the right to meet their children, or to ask if their children would meet them. I came back to it more recently, and I think one of the things that those of you who've worked in an area where it's been personally relevant will probably agree, that you can only do that for so long, and then you need to go and do other things. You need to expand your life, and you need to have a full life, and you need not to dwell on one aspect of it as your the only thing you do. So I left ARMS after about 3 years working there and moved into community mental health, where I spent the rest of my social work career, and then changed direction and became an investigator with the State Ombudsman's Office. And I heard about the state adoption apology. I hadn't really been following it. It had been something that had slipped by while I was investigating councils. That's what we were talking about earlier. And I went to the apology and heard Jay Weatherill, the Premier, and Isabel Redmond, who was the Leader of the Opposition, and both Ministers for Health and Welfare apologise unreservedly to people who had been affected by past adoption practices in South Australia. And my mouth literally fell open, because I had been part of that movement many, many years earlier in the 1980s. And here we were in 2012, and all the things that we'd been saying for nearly 30 years were being acknowledged and recognised. We were being validated as people who'd lost children to adoption, and the work that ARMS had done was also being recognised. And I felt an immense pride in that moment. And I left the apology, and we all went across the road and had a bit of sandwiches or something or other with the Premier. And I met up with some of my friends from ARMS from many, many years earlier. And I looked at them and I said, someone ought to write a book about this amazing bunch of women. And I just retired. And so it was me. And so that was the catalyst for actually writing the book. It was having been there, having been part of the movement, and then having seen this amazing event where our state had actually apologised and acknowledged that some of us had actually lost our children against our wishes, and that there was going to be a national apology by the Prime Minister, Julia Gillard, in 2013. I'm going to step out of this for a minute, because I just wonder if any of you saw the Four Corners program on Monday night on Ireland's lost babies. And Philomena was a film that came out last year. And the television series Love Child, which is tracks the lives of a few young single girls who go into an unmarried mother's home in King's Cross. There's also been a lot of publicity about overseas adoptions, and I noted that Deborah Lee Furness was named New South Wales Australian of the Year, and I think largely because of her work with promoting, getting us to think about overseas adoption as a viable option. I have my own views on it, but they're not for this discussion today. They're not things that I have talked about in the book. And also, there's been a lot of talk about surrogacy. Overseas surrogacy is a means for people to have children. And I guess what we're seeing is that there's this resurgence of interest in forms of adoption or people being able to have children that otherwise wouldn't be able to have. It's a very controversial, fraught issue, and it depends where you sit as to the views you might have about it. What I really want to draw you to is, I guess, that there's a lot of work still to be done in recognising, in particularly in other countries, but also in Australia, in recognising what happened to people who lost children through adoption, and that it isn't a simple case of you can take a child from this person and give it to these people and everyone dances off into the sunset. And I guess if you've seen the series, the television series Love Child, imagine those girls 20 years on, and they are now 40, 35, 40, and all of a sudden they're sitting back and thinking, I hate every moment of being without my child. I wonder if she's alive. I wonder if he's happy. I didn't really want to give him up, but I felt pressured into doing it. And I'd like to be able to know if he's okay. And that's the story of the mothers in arms. They got together because they couldn't remain silent any longer. They needed to talk to one another about their experience, and they needed to have a way of expressing their anger and frustration and their guilt. You know, I signed the consent form. At the end of the day, regardless of how much I would say I was pressured into it by doctors and nurses, my mother, whomever, I signed the consent form. And with that signing comes responsibility. And I have to accept that as part of my experience and the experience of losing my child, that I did sign a form. So if you think about the book, it's a little bit about me, but it's mostly about the journey that we went on. It's the meeting of those women for the first time and coming together to talk about what it was like to lose a child and to actually sit down with one another and say, I didn't really get over it, and have someone say exactly the same thing back. And that power there was of people being together, women being with other women and sharing their own unique stories and finding out that there was a commonality among all of them that was rather perplexing, particularly when it came down to what women were told about why they should give their children up. And the word selfish is a very, very commonly used word among mothers. I just want to take a moment too to talk about why I'm calling this mothers. When I started going to ARMS, we were relinquishing mothers. But it was a long name. Not a lot of women or not a lot of people really knew what it meant. Some people were calling us birth mothers. Some were calling us natural mothers, real mothers, whatever. I thought birth mother was the easiest because it was shortish. I wasn't sure about natural mother or real mother because I was very mindful that my daughter had a mum and dad, and they were her real mum and dad, and her mother wasn't unnatural if I was natural. So for me personally, I never liked the term natural mother because it implied another mother wasn't natural or another mother wasn't real. But there was a lot of controversy about what we should call ourselves, and when I came back to write the book, boy, had things changed. I was there during the 1980s and then in the early 1990s, and then I came back to write the book and I started in 2012. And we weren't calling ourselves relinquishing mothers anymore, or birth mothers, or real mothers, or natural mothers. We were mothers. And it was made very, very clear to me that if I dared to write a book and call us anything other than mothers, that the mothers would never buy it. So, and it was quite difficult because, you know, there are lots of mothers, lots of types of mothers. You know, sometimes you're talking about several kinds of mothers, and I was sitting there wanting to put relinquishing or birth or whatever, and knowing that there was this group of people out there who were waiting to see how I was going to address it. So I've come to terms with it. We're calling ourselves mothers. And that when you hear me talk about mothers in this context, it will be that we are women who lost children through adoption. Not always forced adoption, but adoption. I wanted to write a book that took the reader on an inside tour of the movement. There'd been books written about mothers' stories. Women had written their own stories. There'd been collective works done. There was a small body of research done by one of the people in this audience, who's a good friend of mine. It seemed to me that the thing that hadn't been done yet was actually the story of the collective movement of arms here in Adelaide, which made world history, and I'll come to that shortly as well. And I wanted it to be read by people who may not necessarily pick up a book and read something terribly academic. I didn't want it to be a treatise with references to journal articles and legislation. I wanted it to be, as I would be saying it to you. And I did my thesis on relinquishing mothers, and I bet half a dozen people have read it in the last 25 years, and I wanted it to be read. So I wrote it as we walked through it, and as the women who came after I left continued the journey on. And so one of the things that people have said to me is that, oh gee, you know, we did cry. And I was thinking, oh gee, I don't know, I wanted people to cry. I wanted them to feel uplifted. But I guess part of that feeling uplifted at the end is that you do go through the sadness and the loss and the tears along the way. But there are a couple of little snippets in there, mostly directed at me and my foolish behaviour, that I hope people will get a laugh out of. Where am I in time? Two? Is that beginning of two or the end of two? Right, I'm in the last 10 minutes. When I wrote the book, I interviewed a large cross-section of people. I had a lot from my own memory about what had happened to people at ARMS and the journey that we went on. But I also wanted to talk to people who were there after I left. I wanted to talk to people like John Cornwell, who was the Minister for Health at the time that the government was debating the bill, the adoption bill in 1987. Susan Lenihan, who picked up the reins when John left quite suddenly. And I wanted to interview, and I succeeded in doing that, which was no small thing actually. John Cormann, neither Susan nor John live in South Australia anymore, and I wasn't sure how John was going to be when I rang him. And so I reminded him that, you know, Julia Gillard had just made a national apology to people affected by forced adoption, and hadn't he been clever all those years ago by actually pushing for both mothers and adopted people to have equal rights to apply for identifying information, which hadn't happened in other states. And to his credit, was a pretty radical thing in South Australia. There was a lot of support for giving adoptees the right to look for their birth parents, but not an awful lot of support for giving mothers the same rights. They were a bit nervous about what was going to happen. And in fairness, adoptive parents had been given their children on the understanding that no one was going to come along. They were their children. The birth mother didn't want to come along and couldn't even if she wanted to. So it was quite contentious and quite fraught. John was quite happy to be interviewed and gave a lovely interview, as did Susan. And in fact, Susan came to the book launch and made a wonderful speech. I interviewed public servants who'd worked in adoption services. Most of them were happy to be interviewed but weren't all that sure that they wanted to be identified, but they were a wonderful source of information. And they gave me some really good insights into how ARMS was actually viewed by the department. And one really interesting insight, I'd thought we had a really good relationship with the department. And this one particular worker said, we were so scared of you because you had the power to go to the media and we couldn't. And of course, being a social worker, and any of you who've worked in the public service, you know how hamstrung you are. You know, and there'll be people in the community will be saying, they did this and they said that. And you're sitting in front of your television knowing that you'd love to be saying something about how difficult it is to go public. And so this particular person was saying, we were really scared of you. You know, it was a tense relationship because you could go to the media and you did. And I was amazed because I saw them as being all powerful and us as being really powerless, quite powerless. I interviewed Sue Varden, who was the then Director General for Community Welfare in the 1980s, I'm not sure she was 70s. Who had been immensely helpful to us through those years that we were actually fighting for law changes for birth mothers. I contacted journalists and because I came upon, when I was researching the records which were at the State Library, I came upon an issue that I had all but forgotten about, and it was about a cult that operated out of Victoria during the 1960s and 70s. And when I was working at ARMS, the story hit the media that this cult had been blown open. It was run by a woman called Anne Hamilton Byrne, and it was the cult where they took the children out to a farm near Eildon and dyed all their hair blonde. Now, these people had run an illegal adoption scam in Victoria for many years and had taken babies from young single girls, adopted them into the cult to be raised by Anne Hamilton Byrne and the other people in the cult called aunties. And I remembered it. And I remembered when I was working at ARMS how women rang me and were terrified because they'd gone to Victoria and their babies were born over there. So part of my research was to actually start exploring that. And honestly, I could have written a book about that on its own. And so I contacted the chief investigator who had worked on the case and who had busted the cult. And I contacted one of the women who was also a child who had been taken into the cult and raised as one of Anne Hamilton Byrne's children. Triplets, I think she said they were, and I think she was in her 50s when she had these triplets, allegedly. In reality, they were three children, three babies from three different mothers. One of them didn't even come from Australia. So the book... And obviously I interviewed lots of birth mothers and adopted people, friends, a couple of people who gave me some information that was useful, that particularly about the cult, that they didn't want spread around with their name attached to it. There were some key things that came out of it for me in terms of writing it. One of them was a personal journey that I went on, because when I interviewed mothers about different aspects of their own experience, which of course is integral to them as political activists, because as they were trying to work towards law change, which incidentally South Australia did become the first place in Australia and in the English-speaking world to give mothers equal rights with adopted people. No small thing. And Australia is also the first place in the world to actually apologise to people affected by past forced adoption practices. But when I was interviewing people, it was exciting because I was writing about something that I knew and loved and was interested in, but it was also really quite traumatic because some of the women that I interviewed, I had to take back. And there's one woman I remember vividly, and it's in Pamela's story, and those of you who read the book will probably remember that chapter, maybe more than any other chapter. She goes into an unmarried mother's home to have her baby and has no intention of giving him up, and circumstances are such that she's made to do so and lied to. And I met her at ARMS when she became a management committee member and was I contacted her because I was astounded by her her ability to stay kind to the world and not let it destroy her that she had been treated so badly, not just because she was made to scrub floors and do heavy lifting when she was 8 months pregnant, which it wasn't just didn't just happen in the Magdalen laundries in Ireland, it happened in good old Adelaide as well. And that she was lied to by the matron who said that if she took her baby, she would be put in jail for kidnapping, which they couldn't have done. But I wanted to interview her because of all of those things. But what I needed her to do was to tell me what the quilts looked like on the bed that she was lying on, what was the bedside table like. So it wasn't just interviewing her and saying, can you tell me about that experience? I needed to write it in a way that the reader could imagine those dormitories with their flock mattresses and their chenille bedspreads and their secondhand tatty cupboards beside their beds. And so I took her right back to her experience, right back 50 years to when she'd lost her son. And at the end of the interview, and by this stage I can tell you I had a large glass of red wine sitting by me as I was typing as she was talking. And when we finished the interview and I said, how are you going? And she said, you know, Meg, when that matron told me that I couldn't take my baby and I'd be charged with kidnapping, she said, I didn't know I could take him until I started working at ARMS. And she said, I was totally broken. And when she said it, we both burst into tears. And I wondered how she would go when this book was released. At the book launch, Susan Lenihan got up to talk, and she did a brilliant job, as Susan does. And she said, guess what? She said, I want you to know, I've met Pamela, which wasn't her real name. And she said, Pamela's here today. And I looked over in the vicinity of where Pamela was, and I realised how proud she was of the story that she told and her place in the book, and that as horrible and as hard and as painful as it was to draw that out of her, that she had a great sense of pride and achievement in telling her story. And I didn't feel quite so bad after that, because I knew that I'd caused her and so many other people whose stories I'd told some pain, but they all came away from it thinking about this amazing achievement that they'd made as a collective group in changing legislation and policy and practice and social and opinion, public opinion on adoption. Right, I must be getting really close. Time to wind it up, my sister's saying to me. There's a really interesting bit at the last and I can't remember what it is, so I have to have a look. At the end of the book, in the epilogue, I talk about an issue around consent forms. And you're the first people that are going to hear about this, not about the consent forms if you read the book, but the sequel to Mothers in Arms. When I was researching the book, I went back and had a look at my thesis from 1987. And I remembered an issue that had come up at the time about the consent forms, which were consents to adoption. And as part of my thesis, I had to write about legislation, policy and practice in adoption, blah, 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 and its impact upon relinquishing mothers. And so I'd looked at the legislation, I looked at the policy, and I looked at the practice, and of course I was a recipient of that practice as well, so I looked at my own experience. And I was astounded when I looked at the Act and realised that in South Australia and in other states, that a consent to adoption actually authorised all kinds of permanent care, institutional care, long-term foster care, children's home care. And I'd never been told it. I'd never been told that when I gave a consent to adoption, which I hadn't wanted to do in the first place, that I was actually consenting to my child being placed anywhere. By this time that I was writing the book, so we come forward to a couple of years ago or last year when I started writing it, I'd been working for the State Ombudsman for a number of years as an investigator, and I was pretty good at looking at administrative errors. And so I was interested in this issue about the consent forms, and I went back and looked at what I'd written in the 1980s, and then I started researching it more thoroughly and nationally to look at did mothers actually know that when they gave a consent to adoption, which was the only thing written on the form, that they were actually consenting to their children being placed anywhere the Governor General saw fit or the Minister. And I have not met one mother, and I have interviewed hundreds and I've known thousands over the last 30 years, who was ever told that that consent to adoption had a broader application. Now, for a consent to adoption to be legal, we had to actually understand the meaning of consenting to adoption. So it was obvious I needed to find witnesses, you know, social workers, whomever, government workers who had witnessed consents. And so I started contacting departments and found a few people who said they'd talk to me off the record but didn't want to be identified. And fortunately, some who were quite happy to be identified who said, we didn't tell people that a consent to adoption authorised anything other than adoption because we didn't know it did. We assumed it's a consent to adoption, it must be adoption. One social worker who is very well known said that she did know, but she didn't tell mothers because she didn't want to worry them, quote unquote. So I came away from that book thinking that I wanted to explore it further. And about 2 days ago, I got a letter from the barrister who has been looking at my matter through JusticeNet, and though some of you will know JusticeNet, if you're affiliated with Adelaide University, you'll know that they're over in the law school. They're an organisation who, if they believe that you have a case that's in the public interest, legally in the public interest, or has some significant merit, then they will find a barrister to give an opinion. And of course, I've got no money, and this book's never going to make me rich. And So I went to them and they had a barrister have a look at it, and I got the opinion the other day saying that let's do it, let's apply to the Supreme Court to have my consent overturned on the grounds that due process was not followed. So I'm going to leave it there because you'll see at the end of the book in the epilogue where I draw that issue out a little bit more and say I think I might like to do something about that. Now, I don't want my daughter's adoption overturned. She is 45 years old. She has a mum and dad. I'm her birth mother, her mother who gave her up for adoption. But I don't want a consent that I didn't give willingly and knowingly to sit on record for eternity when I actually didn't give an informed consent. There were people who tried to get some consents overturned years ago, but they fell foul of the statute of limitations, and so they were never able to do it. So I'm not in it for the money. I'm doing it because, I didn't ever give consent willingly, and I certainly didn't know and would never have signed a consent that put my child at risk of never being adopted and me never being told. And I have actually met mothers and I met another one about a week ago, who found out her son died when he was 20 in an institution. She had no idea he'd never been adopted. And those cases are dotted all over Australia. And I'm going to leave it there. If people have questions, or have we got any time for questions, or have I prattled on so long? It's a big thing to take in, and I've spoken a lot. Good. That's fantastic.
You rattled off a list of people that you had interviewed and groups of people that you had interviewed.
Mm.
One group was conspicuous to me in its absence, and I'm sure that you did actually talk to them, but I'm curious about your interaction with adoptive parents and families.
Well, I didn't, because the book was actually is actually about, and I know adoptive parents, no, because
not,
I've got some who are friends.
Yeah.
Certainly have interviewed and have talked with and have met with and have good friends with and was good friends with my daughter's mum and dad. Saying was because they're now deceased. But I didn't interview adoptive parents for this book because the book is actually about the mothers' movement. It's about that organisation. Now, we did actually have adoptive parents who were members of ARMS because sometimes adoptive parents had been mothers who'd lost children to adoption and then couldn't have more children. In fact, there's one really interesting story in the book, but I'll leave it for you to read about it, that covers that. So no, it wasn't the purpose of the book, but I have certainly, and in fact, I have, one of the interesting things about it is that that in some ways in South Australia, unlike some of the other states, we had a really good affiliation with parents of adoptees. And they actually supported us. The head of it was a woman called Lila Newman, who supported equal rights for mothers to look for their children. And when I'm saying equal rights, do you understand what I'm saying when I'm talking about that? That legislation in Victoria was giving adoptees the right to look for their parents, but parents had to go back through the department, and it was at the discretion of the department. So when it came to South Australia, it was a really controversial issue. And in fact, parents of adoptees in South Australia were really supportive. There was another adoptive parents group. In fact, I've got a funny story to tell about that relates to 5UV. And it is in the book, but I'll tell the story. We were such novices when it came to media. I mean, we were just a bunch of ladies that got together because we'd had a horrible experience. But 5UV used to do this wonderful thing called Breakfast at the Hilton many years ago. And I'd done a few interviews, and so I'd sort of started to get a handle on how careful you had to be when you were interviewed. But these things were deadly, because you went to the Hilton on Googer or Grote or wherever it was with the interviewer and someone with a microphone, and we had little weenie button mics, and we sat at this beautiful table with a linen tablecloth and croissants and jam and coffee and toast, and it was just exquisite, orange juice. And we all sat down. I remember sitting down, there was an adoptive parent, not the Lila's group, but people who genuinely believe the law shouldn't change. And I mean, I didn't agree with them, because obviously I wanted the laws to change, but I could understand why they felt that way. Some of these people had never told their kids they were adopted. And so you can understand how terrifying that was for them, that all of a sudden this legislation would open up records and everyone would get carte blanche to whatever. That was what was in their minds. So I could understand the fear and the concern. And this lady was actually a really nice lady. I quite liked her, but didn't share her views. So there were several of us around this table with this beautiful spread, and the 5UV interviewer, you know, was all chatty and clinking of cups, and you know, it was very delectable. And I remember thinking, you watch out, Meg, because this looks like you're just having breakfast and there's a microphone here and you just need to remember this is going to go to air. And so we chatted away, and then this dear lady started saying things that she then said, but I would never say anything to anyone about it because I would never want anyone to know. And of course, she was being recorded, as I am now. And so I'm being careful now not to declare what she actually said. And I was very careful not to declare in the book. But she said things and then said, but I don't want anyone to know about it. And so I started going like this and raising my eyebrows to try and indicate to her that, you know, you are. And she thought that I was snitty with her and that I was actually, you know, disagreeing vehemently with what she was saying. I did disagree with what she was saying too, but I was genuinely concerned for her. Anyway, the upshot of it was that the interview went, and it was a lovely interview, and she left, and I rang her as soon as she got back to work, because as you know, it's pre-recorded, fortunately, and I rang her when I got back to work and I said, You might want to ring 5UV and actually just say something, because do you realise that you actually said all of this stuff and then said you didn't want it to be anyone to know about it? And she was mortified, and no doubt rang 5UV, who no doubt actually removed it from the interview. So there were some very interesting things. So no, I didn't interview adoptive parents, but you did remind me of an interesting story that involved 5UV. Anything else? Yes, I did. In fact, it was lovely, because keeping in mind the parameters around the book were actually around people who'd been ARMS members and who had been part of that ARMS movement. I broadened it out a little bit where there were other things that needed to be discussed, but by and large I needed to keep it to that group who were ARMS members. And there were women who had married the birth father and who were members, and there's this one gorgeous story. I actually interviewed this husband and wife, and he'd been a member, and I said, you know, in the years that I was at ARMS, and I don't know what it was like after, but we never really did seem to do a lot for men, did we? And he said, oh, you know, it's all right. He said, but, you know, I went to a couple of meetings. He said, oh, and you all just sat round, you're sad and talking about your feelings. He said, it was like being in a Woody Allen movie. And he said, I just wanted to go out and bang on a piece of wood. And he ended up being the bloke that made the banners that the women held when they marched on International Women's Day. And that was the thing that he wanted to do. So, yes, I did interview fathers. There's a whole book about fathers, and there's certainly a whole book about spouses who had to put up with us and all our madness, particularly those of us who became really political. I did. And I think ARMS never pretended that it was going to be there really for anybody else other than mothers. But I think it tried hard and it tried to accommodate other viewpoints. And it depended on who was there at the time. Some had pretty strict views about what they believed and others were pretty laid back. And, you know, it depends on the people who were there at the time.
In your research, did you encounter much to do with the public discourse that underpinned the enabling legislation and policy framework that made it possible for those forced adoption practices to be actually implemented? And what would that say about...
The adoption practices to be implemented, or when the legislation overturned those practices?
No, the initial enabling legislation that facilitated the initial...
The book is a much more... as I'm speaking, walk through the organisation. But my recollections from having worked there, and don't quote me exactly on dates with this, but it was there was legislation in the 20s, and then I think closed adoption was really formalised as my memory serves, around the 40s, the 1940s in South Australia. And, you know, there may have been good reasons for it. I mean, there was certainly a time where adoptive parents could know the name of the birth parent. The birth parent wasn't allowed to know the name of the adoptive parents. But in 1966, I think it was, in South Australia, they closed the whole lot up so that birth parents didn't know the identity of adoptive parents didn't know the identity of birth parents, and the adoptee was never going to know the identity of the birth parents either. And it sounded like a great idea, except that, you know, as you can see, it wasn't necessarily. I don't know that I can give you... I'm nervous about speaking more about it because my time working at ARMS was much more involved with the catalyst for change, to actually move away from that legislation and to open records. And I've certainly got lots of anecdotes about stuff that I'd seen in the papers about starting to challenge that view that we were bad girls, that we were sluts and that we didn't love our children and that we danced off into the sunset never having thought about them twice. And there was this real to-ing and fro-ing in the media and the New Idea and Women's Weekly and Woman's Day. There were always articles, and also in the Advertiser and the News, for those of us who remember the news, about... what was going to happen if records were opened and who were these women? And I fell for all of that stuff. I mean, part of the reason why I didn't go to an ARMS meeting for several years was I didn't know what those women looked like. I thought I was okay, but I wasn't really sure about me either, because I'd become pregnant and I wasn't married, so I was not a nice girl as society saw me. But I really wasn't sure about what these other women were like. So even I, as a person who'd experienced it myself, was still persuaded by some of those views that these women were not okay, that they were not nice. Certainly when I researched some of the social work literature on deserving parents, and this is when I was doing my thesis, this might sort of tie in a little bit to what underpinned practice in those days. I remember reading some social work manuals for working with mothers who were going to give their children up. And I was horrified to see that the mental instability was always related to the mother, not to the father, but she was mentally unstable simply by virtue of becoming pregnant. The level of mental instability was, among other things, related to the degree of separation between her and the birth father socioeconomically. So if she were working class and he was upper class, then she was much more disturbed mentally than she would be if they were both working class or if they were both upper class. So there were all these wonderful judgments that were being made about women and only women in relation to what they must be like depending on their age. That was another thing. The younger they were, the more unstable they were, mentally unstable they were. So there was a lot of beliefs, were a lot of beliefs around those kinds of ways of thinking about girls who were pregnant and not married, and that was embodied in legislation. And I think, I don't know, someone must have known we didn't really want to give up our kids because, you know, whilst they were saying, well, you know, they're not going to come back because they've danced off into the sunset and they're really happy to give up their children, but by God, we'll make sure they can't ever find them, so we'll sign, seal and deliver this legislation so they can't, just in case they might want to. So it was there were lots of very conflicting views, I think, and from your groans, I can hear that there are some things that are just outrageous. To a degree, they had their own group, and when we were fighting for law changes, we did work with the Aboriginal community because there's and we always felt that their circumstances were worse, and I don't know why, but we did feel that. Certainly in the time that I was there in the early days, it was a much more obvious removal of children within the Aboriginal community. It was much more obviously shocking, whereas with women like myself, it still takes people even today a bit of thinking about it to look at someone like me and go, you mean you gave up your child? You know, how can you, you're articulate, you're intelligent, how could you have fallen for that stuff? And yet we did. So it may be that, maybe part of the reason why we had a lot of sympathy. We also knew it was very important we let them go first in terms of fighting for recognition, and certainly in the Stolen Generation apology, but it did not elude us when the Prime Minister was apologising to the Stolen Generation, that we were in the wings and that what had happened to our Indigenous sisters and their children had happened to us as well.
Did you feel that you've been able to have some influence on social work teaching in your field?
I drove them nuts. I don't know, I hope so. I mean, one of the things that we did, and there's another social worker in the audience, Evelyn, who had worked at ARMS like I had, and who lost a son to adoption in Scotland. And Evelyn's actually written several books about adoption, about her own experience about adoption and about disenfranchised grief, and has actually made a huge difference in terms of our understanding about grief and losing a child to adoption. When I was at uni, because I did my placement at ARMS, I drove everyone crackers with I'd be going, because once I came out and said who I was and what my situation was, I told everybody I could think of about it. And one of the things that I've done since I wrote the book was to go back to the universities, Adelaide, Flinders and UniSA, and say to them, because there is actually a chapter about the social work profession and its relationship with women who've lost children to adoption, and it's quite a remarkable set of circumstances surrounding the social work, my profession, some of which I'm not terribly proud, and that's not necessarily to do with the historical thing, it's to do with the apology and where the social work profession sits with an apology now, where other organisations and professions are apologising and social work's really struggling with it. But Adelaide and Flinders and UniSA have all picked up this book to be put on their reading list in women's studies and social work. And at Flinders, I think it was Bereavement and Loss was another one. I think it's Bereavement and Loss. So, and my next step, of course, is now to talk to all the other universities around Australia. So I think it has. The other thing that we did when I worked at ARMS and after was I always took social work students because it was a way of sharing that information so that when we went, that you know, it's that, you tell them and then they'll tell someone else and then they'll tell someone else. And so it was a way of educating the next generation of social workers. So I did, and I'll continue to do it, because I think that what surprises me is how how lost it gets in history, and then it gets resurrected and people go, oh, I never knew that, I had no idea. And to me it's like, well, you know, surely everyone knows it, and they don't. And interestingly, I'll finish on this because I think we're about ready to wrap it up, on Four Corners on Monday night, I was fascinated in the program about Ireland's lost babies. And when Kerry, oh, I can't remember his last name, but anyway, you know, the guy that, yeah, Kerry O'Brien, finished, he actually talked about forced adoptions in Australia. But he didn't mention that Julia Gillard had made a national apology. It never got mentioned. It's like it slipped from the pages of history. That remarkable speech that anyone who was there will remember for the rest of their lives. A truly remarkable speech. And he didn't even mention it. And it was history-making, a history-making speech. And you know what? You know, I mean, I think there are a lot of reasons why it's not remembered. But you know what other event happened that day? Simon Crean called a spill. And by the end of the day, no one was remotely interested in Julia Gillard's apology. They were interested in whether she was going to get ousted. Thank you very much for letting me talk for so long. And I went way over my sister's thing. And thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to thank Meg Hale and also thank Deirdre for allowing Meg to speak longer than Deirdre thought she ought to speak. I think that Meg's actually given us a very important plank of social history and understanding in Australia. And although there are harrowing tales and shocking elements of the history, I think what she does do is reinforce the fact that actually South Australia is a bit better than some other places. It's another reason to be proud to be South Australian, because at least we managed to get something right. It may have been belated, but we were progressive. Some politicians saw there was a problem. They acted on your encouragement and things have been improved. So thank you so much for speaking to us. Thank you, Wakefield Press, for publishing the book and doing such a good job. It's beautifully laid out. Don't forget to buy a copy. And may I give you a small gift and thank you for spending your time with us and answering so many questions so generously.
Thank you very much.